4:55, September 18th.
We'll start. It's going. So, everybody should have got back your homeworks from me in an email yesterday afternoon. And except for Joshua, who had a little problem, and so I'll send yours. I have yours, and I'll send it back. Vic is here to answer any questions about the homework that you may have, if they're short. But somebody also asked me to say something about the traceroute problem. And I don't know what the issue was. There was some surprise about what you saw in that. I don't remember who it was. That was you. Okay. So let's quickly catch up with Bori's question.
Yeah, I got the feedback, and I feel a little confused about the transmission rate. Should I ask in office or?
Pardon?
I feel a little confused about what the transmission rate is.
What is the transmission rate?
Yeah, I was thinking it's in the router, and then when I got a feedback, it seemed like it's in the link. I had to think about it.
Okay, I think you should talk with Vic about that specific feedback. Yeah. So I wanted to do that one. The other thing I wanted to say is, let's just be clear that in doing networking, when we talk about a megabit per second or a kilobit per second, we're talking decimal versions of those numbers, 1,000 and 1 million in a decimal sense rather than a binary sense, you know, 1,024 or 1,024 squared. Is not what we're talking about when we talk about networking. And, you know, that's convenient, okay? And it's also true. I mean, that's the way it's used in the industry. We talk about decimal amounts for those rather than powers of two, okay? I think that was the main thing that I wanted to say generally. So, Sean, ask about traceroute.
Well, my question was that when I form my traceroutes, I formed one just on SEL, so it was right near us.
Uh-huh.
I formed one on like a Russian website.
Uh-huh.
And for all my tests, they had the same number of hops to get to the final destination, which struck me as weird because I expected far fewer hops to get to the SEL one. And I didn't really see any changes on... Like, I felt like the network on how I was getting to the Russian one was a more static route as opposed to getting to the SEL, which felt like there were a couple more variables that were changing to reach the traceroutes. And that strikes me as completely opposite of what I expected.
Okay.
I don't know if that was just a fluke or...
Okay. So what network were you starting from? Like WSU network?
Oh, I was starting from my home network.
From a home network.
Yeah.
With what provider? Or the cable.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting point. Let's see if we can reproduce any of that.
It was worth pointing out that on the Russian one, it didn't get to the final destination. It would time out after the same number of hops that the one.
Okay. Well, so we don't really know what that means is you've run into some router that is not willing go any farther. So,
but it was
in Russia?
It was in Russia. It was the same starting IP as the place I was trying to connect to.
Uh-huh. So probably like WSU. If you try to trace route to WSU, you won't get answers either. So just for grins, trace route, and we'll use minus N. The minus N option to trace route, oh, this is really very hard to see. Oops, wrong direction. The minus N option to traceroute just says don't do DNS lookups, reverse DNS lookups to try to figure out the names of things. Makes it go faster. So SEL Inc. I think we have no networking at all on this machine, so that's not going to work.
I don't know if I have the
For some reason, it just gets. Anyway, so what does it mean? It means that the topology of the internet is not necessarily very well correlated with geography.
Well, both connections went to a Seattle, like,
yeah,
before it.
Uh-huh. So what's going on there is that your ISP is connected to the outside world through Seattle, mm-hmm, right? So that's probably not too surprising. From there, SEL is connected to the outside world, probably also in Seattle. It's a little surprising that there are that many hops, but I don't know. For a long time, I haven't tried recently, I switched ISPs at home, I had 17 or 18 hops from my house in Pullman over by Safeway to WSU. Okay, and the weird thing about that was that the very first hop of that was from my house to Orton Hall, and then it went sort of all around the place and eventually ended up back at WSU. So,
and then one other question, yeah, I guess, about my trace routes was that the first one I performed,
uh-huh,
for the first time period,
mm-hmm,
it was fairly normal, but the second one and the third one I performed, it had an extra hop in it that was not the same IP, but it was like inside our same household, and I don't understand why something like that would be showing up. Is that something bad?
Within your house, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you probably should be lugging,
yeah,
into that.
Okay.
Roommates are hijacking your traffic or something. Watch out for your bank accounts. But that reminded me of another. Oh, the other thing I want to say about traceroute is that the way trace. Let me see here. Really? Well, that's not very useful. So ignore the stuff on the background. I don't know what's going on here. The way that traceroute works, remember, is it sends a packet with a limited for a limited distance of one, and waits for the reply, and it does that three times, and then it sends one that will go two hops, and comes back, and then it sends one that'll go three hops and come back, and so forth, and it does each of those three times. And the thing you got to remember when you're looking at those results is that the routes can change in between any of those packets. Right, so some of those packets that have gone one hop may actually go to different places. The ones that go two hops may go different places. So you don't necessarily get consistent data coming back from traceroute. It's more just an impression of what's going on, unless the routes are stable. So anyway, that's that. Any other questions about all of this? Oops. So Vic observed that people did generally well. Most of the scores on those were fours and threes. Four was the highest score you could get. So, yeah.
I thought it was a five.
No. No.
That's much better.
They were scored. 1, 2, 3, 4. So here's how the homework grading works. 4 means you did basically a good job on everything. 3 means maybe some misunderstandings, but still a serious effort. A 2 or lower means that there were deficiencies in not only the answers given, but also the effort put into it. So you don't want to be getting twos. Threes, you know, threes are, you did the work, you made an attempt at it, but there's a misunderstanding, and so that's a sign that you, probably that you need to talk with either Vic or me about the misunderstanding. Two means that you're sort of not entitled to do that, right? In some sense, right? You need to make a more serious effort before you invoke help from Vic or me. Now, which is not to say that we won't help you, but it's sort of a pointed message that says this wasn't really up to snuff. All right. So today we're going to So today we're going to launch into talking about chapter 3, the transport layer. But there's an important message on the first slide here that I don't want to forget. If you looked at the calendar, if you've been looking at the calendar, it said there was going to be an exam next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. I want to postpone that to the following Monday. Okay? So that we can cover chapter 3. Okay, so the exam will cover chapter 3. So that means the exam will be Monday, September 28th. Okay? That's my plan.
This is the first exam I had. It's all staggered out, so we had like a week before another exam.
You wanted it next week?
Yeah, it's fine. Okay. It's less than
2 weeks. September 20th. And so we'll do some review in class on Friday. The schedule I have set suggests that we should be finished on Wednesday with the Chapter 3 material. I actually seriously doubt that we will be. It will slop over into Friday, and then we'll do review as well on Friday. So, now, if we're lucky here. This works. Chapter 3 is following the plan of this book to go top down through the network layers. The next one after the application layer is the transport layer, and what we want to see in talking about the transport layer is basically four things. First of all, how multiplexing and demultiplexing works, and we've already talked about this, so this will be solidification of that understanding. Then we get to the principles of reliable data transfer and the techniques that are used for that. We haven't done that at all before. Flow control, which is another new issue in the transport layer. And finally, congestion control, which is a transport layer service that's provided to the network as opposed to the applications, is maybe the way to look at that. It's kind of a strange thing that congestion control, which really affects the whole network, is actually implemented at the transport layer. But it sort of has to be that way. Okay? So along the way, in the internet, we'll talk about UDP. There's not a whole lot to say there. TCP, there's a whole lot to say there. And congestion control. And I duplicated that slide. Services. It should be becoming second nature now to understand that it is the transport layer that provides end-to-end, application-to-application communication in the internet. Okay? We have the network layer below that provides host-to-host communication. Transport layer does application-to-application communication, and above that sits the application protocol that then figures out what it is that the bytes mean. Okay? But transport layer is application-to-application. Therefore, the transport protocols are implemented in the end systems of the network. They're not implemented in the middle of the network. They're not in the routers in support of application-to-application communication. Typically, the transport protocols are implemented in the operating system of N systems, but they don't have to be. They can be implemented in user-level code as well. But, you know, for most purposes, that socket interface that we've talked about is the interface to the implementation of the transport protocol that lives inside the operating system. So, what's going on? The application tries to send something. The transport code breaks up whatever you try to send, if necessary, into segments that are passed to the network layer. The receive side reassembles those segments into messages and passes them back to the application layer. And the first thing that we're going to talk about is the fact that we have to do this multiplexing and demultiplexing. We've got one network. We've got a lot of applications. We have messages coming in and going out, and they've got to get routed to the right place. That's the multiplexing, demultiplexing story. Okay. In the internet, the primary two transport protocols are TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, and UDP, the User Datagram Protocol. There are others. There's now something called SCTP. I knew it this morning and now I don't. Pardon? Yeah, the something control and transfer protocol, I think, but SCTP. And real-time protocol is another example. There's a reliable datagram protocol that's now been defined. They're not nearly as ubiquitous as TCP and UDP. Okay, so just so it's clear, I'm sort of hammering on this a bit. The network layer is responsible for taking a packet from a host and delivering it to the host. The transport layer provides the further abstraction of taking a packet from an application and delivering it to an application. Okay, so it uses the network layer, but it enhances it. And there's an example in the book describing this, making an analogy between the postal service being the network layer and the parents in the houses actually shuffling mail to the right people in the houses as one way to analogize the difference between the network layer and the transport layer. I don't know. It didn't thrill me. So if it thrills you, enjoy it. But otherwise, don't hang up on it. Okay. So what are then the services that the transport layer protocols provide? Well, they vary, actually, between different protocols. But the kinds of things that that can be provided in a transport protocol are reliable delivery of data. That's not a characteristic of the network layer. The network layer, remember, is best effort. It just does the best it can do. Transport layer, we could implement reliable. In order delivery, do the receivers get the messages in the same order they were sent from the sender? Again, that's not a characteristic of the network layer. The network layer can reorder messages. Remember, we said that could happen. In things like the reliable datagram protocol, I don't want to go there. All right. Let's not do that. Forget congestion control for a second. Flow control. Suppose that we have a very fast sending machine. It can pump out data at the rate of 100 megabits a second. Right? And then we have our toaster sitting on the network that we're trying to control, and it's got a little 8-bit microprocessor in it that needs to read messages now and then. And somehow or other, if we have our workstation communicating with our toaster, we better ensure that the workstation doesn't pump 100 megabits per second into the toaster. It won't handle it, right? That's the issue of flow control. Is there some way that the toaster can say, hey, slow down, that's too fast? Okay. So that's implemented in TCP. And finally, in order to deliver on some of these other services, TCP actually has a connection-oriented model, even though the internet as a whole doesn't have that model. In the internet, it's a datagram protocol. You just fling packets and they sort of go where they go and they get there when they get there. There's no notion of having to be sure that the destination is there before you start sending. Well, in order to achieve these other things, TCP actually uses a connection-oriented model, and so there's connection setup associated with that. Okay, so that's sort of the strong protocol in the internet. The other approach to using the internet network layer is to say, how could application, what sort of interface would I propose for applications to just use the unreliable datagrams that the network provides natively? Okay? And it turns out that you don't need very much to do that. You need something to support multiplexing and demultiplexing, right? Because we said transport is about applications, the network layer is only about hosts. So we'll add a little bit to IP to support demultiplexing and also to ensure that the packets that we get are actually the packets that were sent, some error checking. That's really all we're going to do to IP to get UDP. Okay? Transport protocol, transport layer stuff cannot provide delay guarantees or bandwidth guarantees. Transport layer has no control over that stuff. It really has to involve the intermediate nodes in the network. And so transport layer can't do that, although you might wish it could. Okay, so how does multiplexing and demultiplexing work? This should be a quick review. The idea is we have packets coming in from all over the place, and they need to get sent to the right applications. The way we do that in the socket with the socket interface is to make sure they get delivered to the right sockets, and then the applications talk to their sockets and get the data. But what do we do to the... All right, so back to here. So suppose we have a packet coming in here. On what basis is this network stack of protocols going to decide which application should get it? Right? It has to use information that's in the packet as well as information that's in the state of this machine. So there's got to be something in the packet, and there's got to be something in the state here. And we'll see how that works for the different transport protocols here in a moment. So the what's in the packet or what's in the segment story is this idea of ports. And we talked about ports before, right? We talked at the application layer about well-known ports like port 80 for the web and 110 for mail and the like. Now, the designers of the internet did something pretty smart here. They said, in addition to telling us where it's going, the destination, we will ensure that every segment also includes where it's coming from. So, the TCP and UDP packet definitions have space in them for both the destination port and a source port. Why is this handy? Because it means that the receiver of a datagram can tell where it came from, okay, and where the reply should go. So that was a smart thing to do. At the IP level, similarly, the segments, the packets, contain the datagrams. Subtle differences here. The datagrams contain both the source IP address and the destination IP address. With all of this information, you really know where the datagram has come from. And so you can reply to it. Okay? And so we'll look at this last bullet here is important. The host, this stack here, is going to use the source IP address, the destination IP address, the source port, and the destination port. That's the information it has available to it as it makes the decision about where that's going to go. And the local state, of course, is the thing that says when you get a particular packet from a particular source, destination, and so forth, it needs to go there. Okay, so UDP is called connectionless. We don't usually associate a UDP destination with a particular source. Rather, we just say we've got a socket, it's open to accepting messages from anybody who sends to it. So here's how that goes. He's using Java. All right. So in C, this is the Java style. In the C style, it would be socket one gets socket, and we'd say that it's a datagram style, and then we'd say bind. To some port. All right? So that's what we do for a datagram socket. Any traffic coming to the host that does this, that is UDP traffic and says that port is the destination, will get those datagrams. That's really all there is to it. So you look at the port number in the segment, you find the socket that is bound to that port, and you deliver the datagram to that port, to that socket. The application that's using the socket can then read it from the socket. And the key thing here is that the only check that's made here is of the port number, right? Not of the source address, not of the source port, just the destination port number is used to do this mapping for connectionless demultiplexing in UDP. Stop there. Questions? It's important to understand that because in TCP the story is different. So this is just an example. we've bound this socket to 6428 port number, and any traffic coming in here that says destination port is 6428 gets delivered to that socket.
That's just what I said before.
Okay, so that's the connectionless side. Connection-oriented things are different. In the connection-oriented TCP, the demultiplexing is based on four values: the source IP address, the source port number, the destination IP address, and the destination port number. So that means we have a lookup table for TCP that says I've got to see all four of those things right before I will deliver it to a particular socket. So, let's do an example. It's that one. I don't want to do that one yet. So let's think about a web server. The web server is, the well-known port for the web server is port 80. A client wants to do a web page retrieval. What happens? They start a connection by doing a connect to port 80 on the web server host. The result, remember, of that is that we create a new socket in the accept call for that. So there's a new socket. And in that new socket, we actually associate the port 80 of the server, port 80 server IP, and the port something or other, we don't know what it is, and the client IP. All right? So now we have a TCP connection that for which the, well, let me just pick a number here. 5,471. So we have a TCP connection that requires all four of these things to be right in order to deliver to that socket on the server that's associated with processing that first request. While that first request is going on, the same client can make another connect request to port 80 on the server. Okay? But that connection request is going to come from a different port on the client. So at the same time this is going on, we can have port 80, the server IP. We can have port 5473 and the client IP. Okay? And those are two different connections, right? There will be different sockets on the server associated with those. There will be different sockets on the client associated with those, but they can both exist at the same time because the port numbers are different. Similarly, as a different client connecting from the same port number will have a different client IP address, and so it will be a different connection. So I think with that, we can go on to this picture that illustrates that. Client A makes a request to port 80 from 9157. Client B also makes a request from source port 9157, but it goes to a different socket because it's a different source IP address. Everybody see this? Yeah, DeAndre.
So, just to clarify myself, so the source ports can be the same as long as the IP is different?
The source ports can be the same as long as the IP is different. The IPs can be the same as long as the source port is different.
But in connectionless, they can't be the same.
they can't be the same, right? Oh, well, they can be the same, but they'll all end up in the same place. That's really the distinction.
Let's skip that one.
Okay, so the remainder of the time today, I wanna finish talking about UDP. So that next time we can talk about reliable data transfer. UDP, like I said, is really simple. It's connectionless, right? Why do you want it? Because there are applications that can use that kind of service. I mean, it seems like a very poor service, right? It can lose data, it can deliver things out of order, but on the other hand, it's easy. You don't have to make a connection, and that means that you don't go through, that you don't wait for a round trip time to make a connection. Because it's simple, it has low overhead for networks that are slow and can't pass a lot of data. It doesn't suffer delays trying to recover from lost data that you don't care about. So if we're having a voice over IP phone conversation and a packet is dropped, it's much better to just let that go, miss that little bit of audio, maybe a few milliseconds worth, than it is to make the whole conversation stop while we work really hard to recover that missing few milliseconds of audio. I mean, the ears and brain can cope with that very well. So that's why UDP, right? It just says take the internet model and make it usable from the application layer. Now, just to observe, UDP is an unreliable protocol. It's in its name. It's not user data protocol. Okay, it's unreliable, right? But that doesn't say that you can't use the techniques for reliability that we're going to talk about when we talk about TCP at the application layer in order to achieve reliability. It just becomes a responsibility of the application to do it instead of the protocol implementation. Things like the Sun remote procedure call protocol implement reliability over UDP at the application layer. And so the techniques we'll talk about later will apply to that. Okay, so what do we do? We want to send a message. We remember the story about how we successively wrap a message in ever larger headers and potentially trailers in order to march down through the layers of the protocol stack. So we have the application layer message. We wrap a UDP header around it, and that's what we're showing here. And then eventually when we pass that off to the network layer, we're going to wrap an IP header on top of that. We're not there yet. So what is the UDP header? It just says, like we said before, the source port, the destination port, the length of the message, and a checksum. So we're going to talk briefly about the checksum. The goal of including a checksum is to make sure that the message as received is what was sent in the presence of potential a potential class of errors that are likely to occur in networks, particularly flipped bits, and not too many of them. So there's a interesting bit of philosophy that goes with this, called the end-to-end argument. It basically says, if it's important, spell it right, important to the endpoints, it should be provided by the endpoints, where it here is some arbitrary property. Right? So if it, whatever it is important to the endpoints, it ought to be provided by the endpoints. Why is that? Well, let's consider it in the case of this checksum for detecting errors. A lot of link layer and network layer protocols have built into them checksums of their own, right? That will ensure that a message that, say, that's sent over a particular link is okay. Right? Source, destination. Well, that's nice. That's good. That ensures that the message is okay between those two points. But the internet is designed to work over a lot of different kinds of links. Not all those links have checksums associated with them. Okay? So if it's important end to end, it should be provided end to end. And the ends here, at least as far as the transport layer is concerned, are the applications, right? So we want to check if the application is a care. So we want to check that you know, from the time we send it to the time it's received, it's okay. The other thing about the end-to-end argument, so there are two ways of looking at it. One is that, okay, you've got, if you want it at the ends, you need to provide it at the ends. The second thing is to turn that around and say, well, if the ends are providing it anyway, why am I doing it in here? Okay. So this argument is sometimes applied to remove services from within the network and the link layers because we've already decided they needed to be provided at the endpoints, and it's a waste of resources to provide them inside. Okay? So that cuts both ways. Okay, so the actual UDP checksum algorithm is really to add up the 16-bit words that are contained in the message and the UDP header and put a checksum field in and fill in that checksum field in such a way that it's easy for the receiver to do the same thing and determine whether it got the right answer or not. So you add them up here, you add them up there, and you should get the same thing. And furthermore, the way they do it is they actually... this is not good here. They actually... make it easy to check by saying that what goes into the checksum field is the ones complement of the sum, so that when you add the sum of the words to the checksum, you get a value that's all ones. But this is just an arbitrary rule, right? There are other rules that work just as well. You could define it so that The checksum, when added to the sum, was equal to zero. That would be convenient. And also, there are different rules in different systems for actually doing the computation on all the words of the message. The one they picked for UDP was this very simple addition rule. So it's not terribly important. It can detect a few bits of errors. It's not particularly a strong error checking code. We'll talk more about that when we talk about link layer. For some reason, it's traditional in networking classes to talk about checksum algorithms in talking about link layers. Do you know why that is, Vic? That's what we always do. That's what all the books do. I don't know. I don't know. That's what we do. So that's where we put it, and that's where we will.
That's the CRC then.
So in link layers that we start talking about, the fancier ones are things like CRCs. This is not a CRC. This is something else. Okay, so next time we're going to talk about reliable data transfer. And it would really help if you would look at the book section in chapter 3 on this ahead of time, because this starts to get a little bit tricky. Right? Everything we've done up to now is pretty straightforward. We have numbers, we map them into ports, numbers and ports, we map them into sockets, and computer scientists do all that all the time. Here we're going to start building a sequence of different reliable data transfer protocols that involve state machines running concurrently on both ends of a connection, and it gets a little bit hairy. So looking at the book ahead of time will be helpful for next class. All right, that is what I have for today. Any questions? Yeah?
So is there a limit to the size of the UDP packet, since there has to be a checksum?
It's actually not because of the checksum. It's because of the length field. Yeah, it's a 16-bit number. So 64K bytes.
So the checksum is big enough to hold?
Well, the checksum is just a 16-bit number. So you just add it, you keep adding it up and reducing it modulo to the 16th until you get to the end. So the checksum isn't the limit, but the length is. Okay. See you Monday.